You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 6th, 2011, hump day, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Quite a show for you. I'm exhausted. I was up all night. Our guest, who's going to be joining us in several moments, was also up all night. Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine, she was in Madison. I wasn't up all night. I think she was up all night. The results of the big Supreme Court race in Wisconsin between Prosser, who won the multi-party primary, I guess now just 3 months ago in February, with 55% of the vote, beating the second closest person, Kloppenburg, who got 25% of the vote. So this guy won handily in February, is now down by 309 votes out of 1.5 million votes. 309 votes out of 1.5 million votes. It's literally changing by the moment. There's just a couple of districts that have been in. I don't know if the absentee ballots have been counted at this point. It's unclear. We're going to be talking to Ruth Conniff, see if she has any information, see if she can even speak at this point. She's been up for 24 hours. So we will get to her shortly. And we are probably 36 hours away, 48 hours away, I would say close to 56 hours away from the government shutting down Operation Republican Governance, shutting down the government. No matter how much the Democrats capitulate, these Republicans are determined to shut down the government. It doesn't matter how closely aligned the Democrats or President Obama seem to be ideologically with the Republicans here. The Republicans are just, oh, you're gonna try and prove to us that you're willing to cut the budget too? Well, guess what? We're going to out-crazy you. So it is this sort of just the spiraling down of misfeasance and malfeasance. But the Republicans will shut down the government. And the Obama administration will claim that they won politically by having to cut the budget only by whatever it ends up being, $40 billion. We only screwed over poor people. But it remains to be seen. We're going to be talking about that more in just a moment. But this story I wanted to start with because it's wonderful. I didn't mention this on the show yesterday. I don't think I did. This past week, I guess it was last week, there was a climate hearing held in the U.S. House of Representatives. There were six experts. Now, of course, when you hear that, that means that some Republican nutjobs want to trot out people to talk about how there is no global warming, despite what literally thousands of scientists have studied and concluded that the vast majority, in fact, every peer-reviewed study by scientists has shown
the UN UN group of international of scientists, thousands. I mean, this is settled science to the extent that you can have settled science. But of course, U.S. House of Republicans, U.S. House, the Republicans in the House, the science to them is only what they read in the Bible. And in that case, honestly, if the Bible didn't mention global warming happening, God would take care of it anyways. So they assembled six experts on climate. Only three of them were scientists. I think there was one PR firm spokesperson.
How are you an expert on climate and not a scientist?
you don't understand anything, Matt. it's well, somebody's an expert on how liberals, you know, how Al Gore is fat. I think they probably brought in a nutritionist to prove that Al Gore was fat, proving that there is no global warming. And Ed Begley Jr. Is not enjoyable on TV programs, so there's no global warming. Yeah. Very naive, Matt. And so one of these scientists has been a vocal skeptic of global temperature records. You know, spinning out of the rim of the old supposedly email gate with climate change, where they were talking about this sparked a whole sort of, I wouldn't say cottage industry on the right. I would say like a big box retail outlet industry on the right saying this is proof positive. This is one of those guys who said, yeah, you know, this looks suspicious. So he is a University of California, Berkeley physicist who has received significant funding from the Koch brothers to investigate this stuff. In fact, the Koch brothers donated nearly 25% of the financial support provided to Mueller's project to delve into this information. And it was an independent project, and so he gets brought in front of the committee, and he's done this study to check the validity of these climate global temperature records, rather, I should say, these global temperature records. Check and see if they're valid. And he announces the following, quote, "We see a global warming trend that is very similar to that previously reported by the other groups. The world temperature data has sufficient integrity to be used to determine global temperature trends."
Hey, what happened?
I'll tell you what happened. Guess who ain't getting any funding from the Koch brothers next year? Bye-bye. Now, I guess this guy's skepticism in the past was founded on the fact that he's a scientist, and that's what scientists do. And now he studied it, and...
Hey, what happened?
Turns out that the records are legitimate. David Koch just crossed that dude off his Christmas card list. You're not getting that bonus. And, of course, you know, all the Republicans there freaked out and said, dude, it's really sad to see a guy like this be completely snowed. I found that story hilarious. Meanwhile, the people have dug into Paul Ryan's budget proposal, and the more people are digging into it, and of course, I'm not talking about David Brooks, who, of course, I think has anointed Paul Ryan the most serious individual in the country, because he is willing to really, really stick it to poor people. And frankly, old people. And sick people. Everyone not in David Brooks's constituency. So there's a whole series of pieces basically looking at Ryan's budget and realizing that this thing is really crap. The long and short of it is that there are no savings in this budget. In other words, in the first 10 years of Paul Ryan's budget, because he has extended out the Bush tax cuts, the debt actually increases relative to GDP. His budget projections only start to decrease the debt when we get to 2002. And why is that? Because in 2002, Paul Ryan essentially guts Medicare, guts Medicaid. Now, the media will portray it as, well, it's Medicare and Medicaid reform. It's not Medicaid and Medicare reform. It is the destruction of Medicaid and Medicare. I can tell you that, Evan, you've been taking heart medication? Yeah, I'm giving you, I'm reforming your heart medication. I'm just giving you vitamin C. You may have to supplement this with heart medication, but I'm going to call it heart medication reform. And that's essentially what Paul Ryan is doing here. And this is the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office initial analysis of Paul Ryan's bill. Seniors, disabled, and elderly people would be hit with much higher out-of-pocket care costs, the CBO finds, by the end of the 10-year budget window. So the public debt will actually be higher than it would be if the GOP did nothing in the first 10 years because of the cutting the taxes. But then the spending cuts would kick in. The CBO finds that, quote, most elderly people would pay more for their health care than what they would pay under the current Medicare system. In other words, all he's simply doing is cutting Medicare. He's not cutting the cost of health care. He's not bringing the cost of health care down. He is cutting Medicare. If the current Medicare system were allowed to continue, the CBO found that an average 65-year-old beneficiary's cost would only be 25% of what it would be in the individual private insurance market. Under those plans, those costs would jump to 68%. So you're basically making seniors pay what will amount, for about 70% of the seniors in this country who rely on Social Security as their primary resource of income, you're making them pay nearly 80% of their income in healthcare costs. That's presuming healthcare continues to rise at the level it is. So this is a joke. His budget is a complete joke. In addition, it is the biggest reduction in Pell Grants in history. It amounts to a $17 billion cut. The maximum grant would be cut by $845, 15%. 1.7 million currently eligible students would be rendered ineligible for grants. It will reduce the number of low-income students receiving bachelor's degree by each year by about 61,000. So here's the plan. Keep people as uneducated as possible. They will go into manual jobs. They will work these jobs 2 or 3 years longer than the average person stays healthy because we will raise the Social Security retirement age. Once they get there, they will spend nearly 80% of their income on health care. I don't think that's going to work. Where is my... No, that's not the one, but that still works. We'd like to thank you, Harvard Hoover, for really showing us the way. Now, when we come, after we speak to our guests in Wisconsin, we're going to talk about what the end game here. And the end game probably is that cat food commission recommendation. I mean, I really think we're getting rolled here. Not just because the Republicans are insane, but also because the Democrats, I think, ideologically are probably not so far, at least in terms of this administration. And the only, of course, I think the plan is basically the Republicans shut down the government. You've got a situation where soldiers will not get paid. Now, they'll get back pay, obviously. Eventually, the government will run again. But one has to presume that they have things like mortgages to pay and insurance premiums to pay for their families. I don't know what happens in that instance. Probably penalties assessed by Bank of America as the Republicans fight the any attempt by Elizabeth Warren's Consumer Financial Protection Agency from protecting them from stuff like that. John Bonair claims that Democrats will win politically in a government shutdown. That may be the case, but the real question is, what will they win? $33 billion of cuts? We have a revenue problem in this country. And cutting from our budget is simply going to tank the economy. All right, folks, we got to take a break. We'll be right back with Ruth Conniff, political editor of The Progressive, live from Madison.
Are you fascist about to lose? You fascist about to lose. You fascist about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascist about to lose. People are big, we call them marching side by side. Marching across the fields with a million fascists are just about to lose. You fascist about to lose. All you fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists about to lose. I'm going to this battle, take my
we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Ruth Conniff, she is the political editor of The Progressive. She is live in Madison, Wisconsin. And I want to start off by thanking you, Ruth, because my understanding is that you have not slept all night.
Yeah, like everybody else in Madison. It's the night that never ended. We've been watching the constant switching of the lead in the Supreme Court race. It's incredible.
Yes, my understanding is that Kloppenburg is up by about 200 right now, and we still have a couple, just a few districts that have yet to report.
Well, that's right. The latest that I had, and I think everybody in the city of Madison is hitting refresh on their AP website every few minutes here, is about 224 vote difference between the candidates with Kloppenburg up. And at about 10:30 this morning, that turned over from a Prosser lead. So, you know, we keep on biting our nails. And there are some absentee ballots that are still out. There are some precincts that have not quite finished reporting everybody. But as I scan down the AP website here, it looks to me like, you know, we have one precinct left in Jefferson County. We have, you know, it's getting close. So we're going to know today. The thing is, even when we know the total, we're so far from a definitive number that there's going to be a recount. The candidates can ask for a recount themselves. The state will pay for it if there's a 7,000 vote gap. And since we have 200 vote gap right now, I think there's no doubt that that's going to happen.
Tell me, Ruth, do we have a sense of how many absentee ballots there may be out there, or what the timing of this recount might be? Do you have any sense of that, about those details in general?
Well, you know, a lot of people voted early. And as it turns out, when you vote early, at least in Madison, your ballot doesn't get counted right away. So those are some of the late votes that we're waiting on. And Dane County, you know, turnout in Dane County was more than 50%. It was just huge. And it was hugely heavily, you know, 73% for Kloppenburg. So that could be very, very significant. You know, there are some other outlying areas of the state where a few more ballots coming in. When you're talking about a 200 vote margin, it is still a complete and total nail biter. It's not for sure in the bag for either candidate, and it's going to go to recount. But I tell you what, when you get 600,000 to 700,000 more voters than the state predicted, that is really significant. I mean, this was a huge referendum on Scott Walker, and people just poured to the polls like nothing we've ever seen. It was historic.
Given the disparity between the votes for Prosser and Kloppenburg during the open party primary just a couple of months ago, this is pretty stunning stuff.
Yeah, I mean, even a week ago, the state was predicting 20% turnout. This is a nonpartisan spring election. People don't get that motivated usually. And, you know, when they got 33.5% turnout and well over 50% in Dane County, you know, it was just stunning. And there's no doubt that that is motivated entirely by the controversy over Scott Walker. I mean, Prosser was expected to walk away with this thing. Nobody had ever heard of Joanne Kloppenburg. People don't pay that much attention to state Supreme Court races generally. So, you know, and another thing that's important to note, I think, is that the margin of the vote that was way more than the 20% the state predicted, it's like 600,000 to 700,000 people, you only need 540,000 signatures to start the recall of our governor. Mm. So just the margin of new energized voters that they didn't expect is way more than the number of signatures they need for that recall.
And the Milwaukee County executive race, that my understanding is that was also a huge rebuke to Scott Walker.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, not what people expected to see. You know, of course, he's from Milwaukee. He was the Milwaukee County executive. You know, there were a number of races around the state that seemed like real indicators. Appleton, home of Joe McCarthy, just elected a Democrat as well. He was Tom Barrett, Walker's opponent's running mate. So there's a very, you know, there's a very big shift going on in this state. There's a huge, huge battle going on here. And despite the fact that this was the most expensive state Supreme Court race in history, you know, that there was tons of outside money that came in to buy these sleazy television ads, I think the big story here is just democracy, you know, and the fact that voters just turned out in massive numbers. It's really energizing the recall campaigns against the Republican senators who are eligible for recall now, and the sense that people really can make a difference, and they're coming out to try to do that.
And Ruth, just give me, I just want to get your take on this. I was out in Madison a couple of weeks ago, I guess at the beginning of the month, for the last big rally following Scott Walker's signing of the bill that stripped unions of their collective bargaining. And my sense was in this protest that the protest was far broader than simply a union protest or a union battle, that this was more of a labor battle and a protest against the actual budget that Scott Walker was imposing, aside from the collective bargaining aspect, but the budget itself is incredibly unfair.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this has been so dramatic. You know, I mean, it's really hard to even describe the level of energy, and it is, you know, people make comparisons to Egypt. They did early on when those huge rallies, huge spontaneous rallies were happening at the Capitol here. It's, you know, this sense that you go out and you see everybody that you know, school teachers, firefighters, cops, you know, it's really this very broad cross-section of the population of the state. And, you know, just the sense of the level of threat, you know, the aggressiveness of this Republican administration is really hard to overstate. I sat in hearings on the Education Committee, the Senate Education Committee here, where people came out, they registered to speak, they stayed all day, teachers, students, parents from around the state, to say, if Scott Walker's education proposals go through, all these tiny towns in northern and western Wisconsin are going to lose their public school, and then their town is going to become a ghost town, because that football team, that, you know, school choir, that's the heart and soul of these little communities. And I think this is what we're seeing in the recall campaigns against the Republican senators in the state, is that they have to go back to their little town and they have to explain a kind of extremism that is going to fundamentally transform their communities, destroy their schools, bankrupt their municipalities. And really, you know, people are up in arms about this.
Well, Ruth, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I know how exhausted you must be, and I appreciate talking to you. And hopefully we can check in with you once we get some results.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
All right, Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine out of Madison. We got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. All right, we're back. Sorry about that echo on my end. I tried to not speak very much so that it's more interesting what she had to say anyway. So we've got the situation. It's going to go to a recount there. Still unbelievable results. And it's going to be interesting, too, because this was not only a bellwether as to what was going on in that state in Wisconsin, but it also has real practical implications. It's very likely, or very possible, I should say, that Scott Walker's anti-union bill and his budget, for that matter, may end up in front of the state Supreme Court. So the implications for this election are rather large. But one thing is for sure, if I was one of those Republican state senators who is eligible to be recalled, or if I was Scott Walker, eligible to be recalled, I would be willing to schedule a vacation shortly after that election. But amazing what's going on there in that country. In the meantime, we have the budget proposal from Paul Ryan. Adam Serwer weighed in with David Brooks's comments. His proposal will set the standard for seriousness for anybody who wants to play in this discussion. What a horrible sentence that is anyways. It's serious play that we're engaged in here. It will become the 2012 Republican platform no matter who is the nominee. Any candidate hoping to win that nomination will have to be able to talk about government programs with this degree of specificity, so it will improve the GOP primary race. And Serwer talks about his visiting the Charles Murray American Enterprise Institute lecture on the state of white America. Not joking about that title. And apparently he's writing a magazine piece about it. I want to have him on for that. But he says that Murray's basic conclusion was that something went deeply wrong in the mid-1960s, an idea that caused everyone in the room to nod their heads solemnly. And the basic thing that went wrong was that President Lyndon Johnson's extension of the American welfare state undermined the essential virtue of the American people by making them soft, weak, and lazy, where they were once hard, strong, and industrious. American decline can be traced to this moment. Liberals laugh at that old Ronald Reagan speech declaring the end of freedom with the advent of Medicare, but conservatives actually think that on some level he was right. That's the kind of moral outlook that's guiding Ryan's proposal, which basically abolishes Medicare and Medicaid as we know it, while shifting the tax burden to the less well-off. Now, I have an alternate theory here that maybe is not so alternate. There's something else that happened in the mid-60s under Lyndon B. Johnson. Black people were perceived as equal citizens to white people in this country. And Tim Weiss, who we've got to get on this program, has argues that underpinning this entire anti-welfare, the welfare queen coming out of the Cadillac, is some form of racism. And I think the title of this was really The State of White America, this lecture. But, I mean, there's no coincidence that that's the title. And they talk about how the American people got weak and soft and lazy right in those mid-60s. A sense of moral panic, moral panic over the erosion of traditional values is present in every strain of American conservatism. I think you could easily, and maybe it's not even a contradiction in any way. What are the traditional values that they are hearkening back to? Well, I know one traditional value that was extremely prominent in this country for nearly half of its existence. That was slavery. And certainly for three quarters, seven eighths of its existence. We were subjugating at least, you know, depending on half the population at one point before women could get the right to vote and black people. That's also a traditional value of America. It could be the defining traditional value of America. It certainly was it's the most tangible. I mean, we can talk about individualism and ruggedism and optimism and all that. Yeah, you can't hold that in your hand like you can a chain that is yanking somebody. Or a law that says you're not allowed to vote here. You know, when Pat Buchanan talks about traditional American values, he's talking about white people in charge and white males, for that matter. And maybe the right has spent time sort of like mixing that in with a sense of moral turpitude and integrity and strength and diligence, and perseverance. Kevin Drum also had to say about the courageous, serious, gutsy Paul Ryan. I imagine that within a few days, this will be the consensus view of the entire Beltway punditocracy. A plan dedicated almost entirely to slashing social spending in a country that's already the stingiest spender in the developed world, while simultaneously cutting taxes on the rich in a country with the lowest tax rates in the developed world. Well, what could be more serious than that? I think I'm going to be sick. And then it's not simply coming from the David Brooks. Ezra Klein, who writes what I consider to be one of the most contradictory paragraphs I've ever read in my entire life. First, he talks about how the House Republicans don't want to take yes for an answer in terms of making a deal. You know, first, Bonaire said cut $33 billion. Then the Democrats met them halfway by saying, okay, we will cut $33 billion. Halfway being a joke in that instance. That's generally considered the full way. And then Bonaire increases his demands to $40 billion and so on and whatnot. Because the Republicans clearly, this is an ideological fight for them. And not even an ideological fight. Because an ideological fight implies that there's some measure of practicality to get to an ideological goal. This is just a political fight. This is just their jihad. At one point, you begin to realize there's no even rationality, even on their own terms here. They are preening for their moronic base. So Ezra Klein writes, in the end, the same must be said of Paul Ryan's 2012 budget proposal, this being that the Republican conference would rather a fight versus victory. In the end, the same must be said of Paul Ryan's 2012 budget proposal. You can and should admire his policy ambition, but he is looking for a confrontation, not a compromise. Now, first off, what does that mean? What is the policy ambition here? This goes to the hub of what is wrong with, and I think Ezra would identify as a liberal-leaning, left-leaning wonk. What does this mean, policy ambition? Because he goes on to say he's looking for a confrontation, not a compromise. Well, he's also not even looking for a victory. You just said the same can be said of his budget. For little obvious reason, he goes on to write, his budget repeals the Dodd-Frank financial regulation law and cuts back on green energy development in deference to domestic production. Neither policy has much budget impact. But both are a thumb in the eye to liberals. Well, first off, what does policy ambition mean? if he includes in his budget stuff that has nothing to do with policy? Secondly, is Dodd-Frank financial regulation, is this really a thumb in the eye to liberals? You could argue theoretically it's a thumb in the eye to the Tea Party too, isn't it? Don't they have a problem with the banks? On green energy, is it a thumb in the eye of liberals in this country? I don't understand what the point of policy is, of even being a wonk, if good policy or policy ambition doesn't directly go to improving the situation from a technocratic standpoint as opposed to a political standpoint. What he's writing here makes no sense. Elsewhere, his budget looks to privatize Medicare / Medicaid and food stamps and sharply cut non-defense discretionary spending. But while it does this, it locks in the Bush tax cuts and then cuts corporate taxes. How can his document be policy ambitious? What is there to admire about his policy ambition? If, as you've reported in the past, his numbers are bullcrap, the Heritage Foundation numbers he cites are complete bunk. This is more or less Ezra Klein's words, not mine. If there are things like repealing Dodd-Frank and green energy development to no discernible end in terms of policy, don't affect the budget. If you have already said that this proposal is so whack that it's really just meant to create a confrontation, what is the policy ambition here? What is the point of policy? Is he saying that the numbers that he's written down all seem to be accurate? There's no sense here. There's no sense here, but it's just a function of this establishment speak. And frankly, there's every reason to believe, as Ezra predicted, is the fiscal commission's plan, this is the cat food commission, plan perfect? Not even close. But it's a lot more reasonable, a lot less ideological than Ryan's budget. And I think Ryan's budget is going to persuade a lot of Democrats to give it a second look. So in other words, they have successfully moved what is known as the Overton window, the window of debate. Because there is no alternate Democratic plan, not to cutting the deficit, but just in terms of a policy prescription for our economy. Because the Obama administration appointed the whole entire cat food commission. Ryan comes out with something that is completely draconian, that makes the also draconian cat food commission look reasonable. David Dayen weighs in. With respect to the current budget debate, Republicans initially called for $33 billion in cuts. Democrats met them. Republicans said no, wanting more. And now Democrats are positioning themselves as the serious people by offering an imitation of the Republican budget. You can see exactly the same dynamic at work here. The Ryan deficit reduction plan goes beyond the Bowles-Simpson's cat food commission plan. So you can absolutely see the Democrats' counteroffer with the Bowles-Simpson plan. Now, of course, we all know there really is no cat food commission plan because they couldn't get their commission to agree on a report. So it's really just these two guys, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, both conservatives. Bowles worked for Bill Clinton, but was a major advocate of privatizing Social Security. That would have worked out nice. And former Senator Simpson, we know, thinks that people who get Social Security are greedy and sucking off the teat. They're teat suckers, as he would call them. And so we're in a position where we're basically getting rolled. And we're heading down this austerity trail, cutting taxes for millionaires, cutting taxes for billionaires. And we're going to get rolled. That's the bottom line. I'm going to go 5 minutes over because I didn't get the Supreme Court stuff that I wanted to talk about yesterday. Glenn Greenwald has a great piece up. I'll talk about it tomorrow. The impotence of loyal partisan voters. Maybe we'll try and have Greenwald on to talk about it. But in the meantime, a couple of Supreme Court rulings. And it is the Supreme Court that remains my only reason at this point for potentially voting for Obama. It's the only reason. And frankly, he won't because his popularity is plummeting. But if Bloomberg was to jump in, I don't know that I wouldn't vote for Bloomberg at this point. If we're going to get Bloomberg's policies, why not have Bloomberg himself? I mean, honestly. Do you think Bloomberg would do anything less than the Cat Food Commission? Do anything more? I don't. Socially, he's probably to the left of Obama. He can afford to be. He's a white guy. But, I mean, do you think a Bloomberg administration would look fundamentally different from an Obama administration? Maybe we'd get probably see better work on the civil liberties front. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Meanwhile, and I don't know that his picks would be any different for the Supreme Court. I'm not sure. I believe that Obama's would be slightly to the left of Bloomberg's. Maybe. Maybe. Not even sure. The Supreme Court on Monday made it harder for taxpayers to bring court challenges of government programs that aid religious organizations, throwing out a lawsuit against an Arizona tax credit program that helps private schools. In a 5-4 decision. And you know who the five are, and you know who the four are. You've got Sotomayor, Ginsburg, Breyer, and I don't even remember anymore because they never win. And Kagan, sorry. On the four. And Kagan wrote the dissent. She criticized the court's majority and the Obama administration, which she previously served. She wrote, it threatens to eliminate all occasions for a taxpayer to consent to the government's monetary support of religion. This had to do with the notion of standing. In general, individual taxpayers do not have standing, or essentially the, I guess, the legal right or the jurisdiction, to challenge spending decisions of the government. But in 1968, Flast v. Cohen allowed for a narrow exception when the spending is alleged to violate the Constitution's prohibition on establishing religion. For 13 years, Arizona has allowed a resident to send up to $500 of the money he owes the state in income taxes, $1,000 for a married couple, to a private student tuition organization. So if you owed $4,000, you could send $1,000 as a couple. You could send $1,000 to one of these student tuition organizations. These organizations receive $55 million a year, and they provide scholarships to private schools, often religious ones. The largest of the organizations benefits Catholic schools in the Phoenix areas. Challengers said the program was unconstitutional because it transferred funds that otherwise would have gone to the state treasury. But Supreme Court Justice Kennedy made a distinction between a government expenditure and a tax credit. When Arizona taxpayers choose to contribute SDOs, they spend to these student tuition things, they spend their own money, not money the state has collected from respondents or other taxpayers. So in other words, even though your tax bill is this, because the state has not collected this money yet, it's still not tax dollars. This is absurd. This is absurd. The decision did not directly hold the program constitutional, but said those objecting had no standing to challenge it. Who can challenge it? Who can challenge it then? Kagan said the opinion offers a roadmap, more truly just a one-step instruction, to any government that wishes to insulate its financing of religious activity from legal challenge. Why couldn't we just say, look, everybody's tax dollars. We're not going to collect it. If you decide you want to donate it all to the Church of Scientology. Right? I mean, what's to prevent the government at that point from doing that? It's stunning. It's stunning. They are, and this is not just about the constitutionality of this program. It's also about making sure that the door is completely shut to individual citizens to get any type of redress from the courts. Coincidentally, the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Act, which the law more or less says that candidates who are outspent by a significant amount of money can receive a modest subsidy from the state so that they can be competitive. Well, that was struck down as unconstitutional. Roberts said to the lawyer defending the Arizona law, I checked the Citizens Clean Elections Commission website this morning, and it says this act was to, quote, level the playing field when it comes to running office. Why isn't that clear evidence that it's unconstitutional? This court does not accept the notion that massive amounts of money can actually squelch freedom of speech. There is a complete lack of acceptance that technology and mass media, fueled by money, has an implication on free speech. And they do that simply because that they favor money. There's no two ways about that. This again was a 4-5 case. Just opens up the door to more. It's Citizens United Plus. That's all it is. And meanwhile, in another 5-4 ruling, justices overturned a jury verdict awarding $14 million to a guy named John Thompson, who spent 14 years on death row, came within weeks of execution because prosecutors had knowingly hid exculpatory evidence. They hid a blood test and other evidence that would have shown unequivocally that he was innocent at the time of his conviction. And the court did not find that these actions warranted the liability of these prosecutors. In general, prosecutors are kept are absolved of liability, so that if they make mistakes, they can't be punished in this respect, as long as their intent was pure. How do you hide blood evidence and other evidence multiple times from the defense and not be considered malfeasant? You know, not only should the guy get $14 million, this prosecutor should go to jail, as far as I'm concerned. The guy should go to jail. I mean, I think he's dead now. But they could dig his body up and put it in jail. All right, we gotta go. Show is over. Please join me on the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, we are very, very close to a phone system. But with this phone system comes added cost. We've upgraded our servers so that our site doesn't crash. With more people coming to visit the site, We've upgraded our servers so our stream doesn't die. We have upgraded the quality of our encoding so that the dulcet sounds of my voice are dulcet. We're going to bring phone calls on. This creates more expense. Matt, our social media czar, requires a constant stream of methamphetamines into his blood system.
I do.
This is not free by any stretch of the imagination. Not to mention the tremendous amount of risk that I run involved driving down to Dixie to pick this up at some meth lab down in one of our friendly southern states that I won't talk about. None of this comes cheaply, folks. So please, if you can become a member, please do. Your support is greatly appreciated. And thank you for continuing to buy all of your junk through Amazon at our Amazon link. You can click on that link and you can bookmark it. You can buy all your stuff there and you can transfer wealth from this corporate entity into this budding corporate entity that is the Majority Report, this juggernaut. And of course, thinking of Madison today, you got to think of JustCoffee.coop. These guys gave free coffee to all the protesters out there. They're a fair trade coffee company, and you get 10% off when you enter the coupon code MAJORITY when you buy coffee. See you on the flip side, ladies and gentlemen.